All right, there are some further major points I want to go into in connection with Supplement 6. Let me make a few preparatory remarks. What we're attempting to do here is really undertake some a truly monumental task. If you think about the nature of economic activity, there are billions of individuals participating in it, producing thousands or tens of thousands of different commodities. There's buying and selling every day throughout the world. And there's truly an incredible number of things going on, and it's vastly greater than any mind is capable of holding.
Even yours?
Even mine. And now, the trick is to reduce what's out there, to grasp the essentials, but to do it in a form that can fit within the size of a human brain. Let me give you a physical analogy. When we eat beef, you wouldn't attempt to jump on the back of a cow and start chewing, right? The cow is too big. Look at the relationship. We start out there is the cow, and here's your mouth. And your mouth is a pretty small object compared to the size of a cow. Yet you want to eat beef. So what do you have to do? Well, you have to engage in a process of reduction. You have to get the beef down to a size that's commensurate with your mouth. That's why we have butchers, but it doesn't stop there. When you buy a steak or whatever, the job is not finished. You have to get it on your plate, and then you go to work on it with a knife and fork, and you finally got it reduced to bite-sized chunks that you can chew and then swallow. And that's the way we approach eating beef. Well, there's something similar that we have to do intellectually if we want to have any hope of understanding anything as vast as the worldwide economic system. We have to reduce it to a number of units that are sufficiently few so that our mind can grasp them. And there's a way to do that, and it's called making simplifying assumptions. We make simplifying assumptions. We start recognizing the extent and the variability of the facts that are out there, and then we reduce them to as few conceptual representations as possible. So we've already done this to a considerable extent. We know, for example, that capital goods are being used up and worn out. We also know that some are used up in their entirety at one fell swoop, like the steel sheet to make an automobile or the flour to make bread. Others are used up only over the course of many years, like an automobile factory. And there's all kinds of different things in between. But we do know that all the capital goods, sooner or later, are used up and that they have to be replaced, and that the physical source of replacement is production. Well, to simplify all this, we've assumed in the development of various diagrams that all the capital goods are used up within 1 year. And we're looking at production over the course of just 1 year at a time. Now, we know that in reality, it spans many years and the periods of time span are different for different goods. But to get a handle on it, we assume that everything is used up within 1 year. And we just deal with capital goods and consumers' goods. And we assume that the labor and capital goods that produce the one could equally well produce the other. That's not perfectly true, but it's not so far off. Now, there are some further assumptions that we need to make, and that is we assume that all the buying and selling in the economy goes on 1 day a year. That way, we can put it aside. We don't have to be continuously focused on it. And in the light of that, we're in a position to proceed. And we've more or less been doing that without making it terribly explicit, but that is what we've been doing. And here we'll carry it to its fullest extent. I showed you this diagram briefly last week, and we'll look at it a little further here. Its elements shouldn't be all that big a surprise. It builds on the figure 16.1 that we looked at earlier this evening. The only difference between this and that is that it permits us to grasp not just an income statement for the economy, but also a balance sheet. And here we are. We have different years, year one, year two, on down, year three. And in each of these years, we have three different rows: opening assets of business, transactions, and then production. And we assume that in each of these years, business begins the year in possession of the following assets. It's got 1K of capital goods, and we put in a cost value of 400. It also has 1,000 units of cash in its possession, waiting to be expended, 1,000 units of cash to be paid out. Then it's got 1C of consumer's goods at a cost value of 400. Now, can anyone recall how we would derive these cost values? It's the same cost values that we used before. Well, we're assuming
it was 500 in capital expenditure and 300 in wages.
Yeah, we're assuming that each year, year in and year out, there's a demand for capital goods of 500. There's a demand for labor of 300. And that's where we get 800, and we'll have 1K of capital goods at 500 and 1L of labor at 300. And we already saw that, in fact. And that's what gives us 800 of total costs, and it'll be 400 of cost for the consumer goods, 400 of cost for capital goods. We have it up here because we're assuming that this year one actually follows an earlier year, which we could think of as year zero. And before that, there was year minus one. And we're just jumping in the middle somewhere in an indefinite series of years, in each of which 800 is expended for means of production, and there's 1,000 of sales revenues. Now, here we're showing that there's this 1,000 of cash that's in the hands of business firms. The cash is huge. It's unrealistically large, because we're assuming that all the expenditures for the whole year are made on one day. Now, in reality, the same sums of money are spent and re-spent multiple times in the year, so the size of cash relative to other assets is a lot smaller than I'm representing it here. But we want to look at the buying and selling, and we assume that goes on day one of each year. Then we put it aside. We have the various transactions, and then on the basis of the transactions, we're ready for production. We assume the production process takes a year, and then we have a fresh act of buying and selling on the first day of year two. So here we are. What this setup enables us to do, since we have the assets and we'll have the income statement, we're in a position to actually calculate an economy-wide average rate of profit. We can calculate, A, what is the total amount of profit. We've been doing that repeatedly. And again, it's going to be initially 200. But we're also able to see what is the total amount of capital invested, at least implicitly. What's the total value of assets? What's the total monetary value of the assets in row one? In row one,
1800.
It's 1800. There's the value of the capital goods. The book value of the capital goods is 400. The book value of the consumer's goods that businesses possess, that's 400. So the value of the physical assets is 800, and that 800 came from the productive expenditure of the year before. And there's the 1,000 of cash. So the grand total of cash and the physical assets is 1,800. Okay, that's the opening assets. That's the way things start off. business possesses these goods. They're ready for sale. It has 1C of consumer's goods. They're ready for sale. Now what happens? Well, of this 500, of this 1,000, 500 is expended to buy capital goods. That's the source of the demand for capital goods. And here we are. This is the demand for capital goods. I have an upward sloping arrow. These 500 buy this 1K of capital goods. Now, bear in mind what all this represents. All the business firms taken together in the entire economy have 1,000 of cash. All of them are buying capital goods. Each of them is buying capital goods from other firms. Like General Motors is buying capital goods from U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel may be buying some capital goods from Hanna Mining, from other manufacturers. But notice the cash to buy the capital goods comes from business firms. It underlies the demand for capital goods. Then that cash exchanges for the existing 1K of capital goods that is in business firms' inventory. All right, so what is the sales revenues here to this extent? 500 so far. That's what's received. What is being sold?
400.
What's being sold is 1K of capital goods, which has a cost value of 400. And then notice what's done with this 1K of capital goods that's purchased. Follow it around. It's going to be used in production. There's 1K of capital goods that have been acquired for 500. They're going to serve in production. This is the production box. Now, there's a further 300 of cash that's paid out for wages. So here's wages 300. And the labor that's employed, that's used in production. And this is 1L of labor that's paid 300. And this 1L of labor is acquired at 300. It results from the payment of 300 of wages. But then, and also the final 200 of cash is expended to finance net consumption of 200. And the net consumption and wages together, that's the source of the demand for consumers' goods. Okay, this demand for consumers' goods, that represents the money exchanged for the 1C of consumers' goods that has a cost value of 400. I have arrows going both ways. The money goes this way, the consumers' goods go this way, into the possession of the consumers. All right, when all is said and done, after all these transactions have cleared on the first day of the year, how much cash ends up back in the hands of all business firms taken together?
1,000.
It's still 1,000. And that's going to be why, at the start of year two, business again has 1,000. It's expended its 1,000 and taken it back in. And now, of this 1,000, it's expended 800 for the means of production, 500 demand for capital goods, 300 of wage payments, and those means of production are now used in the course of production. And what are they producing?
Professor, just really quick.
Yeah.
I'm going to touch 10 grand on $500 or 500 units of cash.
Yeah.
Demand for capital goods.
Yeah.
What do you mean when you say it has a cost value of 400?
Okay, we can see that. We'll see where that comes from right here. How much is expended for these capital goods?
500.
500 is expended to buy them.
Okay.
Momentarily, ignore the cost value.
Okay.
You can ignore it and ignore this cost value. All right, 500 is expended to buy these capital goods.
Okay.
And 300 is expended to employ 1L of labor.
Right.
Okay, so what's the total value of these means of production?
800.
800. And now how are they employed?
Ah, you go split it, I see.
Oh. Exciting.
How are they employed?
I believe they're 50%.
Okay, 50-50. And what makes them 50-50 is that the demand for capital goods down here is going to be 500, and the demand for consumers' goods 500. So that's why they divided 50-50.
Got it.
Okay. And so half of 800 is
400.
Okay. And the reason it's 400 up here is we assume that there was a previous year, year zero, in which the same thing happened. Okay. So that's where we have the cost values. All right. And we know in a position to see how much profit is being generated and what is the amount of profit? 200, which results from 1,000 of sales revenues and 800 of costs. And the 800 of costs come from 800 of prior productive expenditure. Okay, we know the amount of profit. Now we also know the amount of capital invested, which is 1,800, right?
Right.
So what is the economy-wide average rate of profit? If 200 is the amount of profit, 1,800 is the amount of capital on which it's being earned, the rate is 1/9 or 11.9%. So here we are, we're in a position to make a calculation of the precise economy-wide average rate of profit, 11.1%. Okay, and here we are, this is a stationary economy, and we've identified what is the rate of profit. All right, this framework gives us the ability to provide a kind of laboratory test for two very major questions in macroeconomics, which are very closely related. One is, does capital accumulation, does a growing supply of capital goods in any way cause, imply, or presuppose a falling rate of profit? Must the rate of profit fall in order to have capital accumulation? This is a very major question. If it were true, it would mean that the richer we become, the lower must the rate of profit continually be.
I'd say that's false.
Pardon me?
I think it's false.
All right, well, we're out to see if it is true or false. I also believe that it's false. I think if it were true, it would be extremely disturbing. After all, the profit is the thing that drives the economy. And if the rate of profit were continually falling, it would go on falling without any limit as the necessary precondition or accompaniment of economic progress. Well, I would liken that to the sun gradually burning out, which is something that we would not want to see happen. And I think it's very important that, to recognize that the economy is not, in fact, governed by the equivalent of a dying sun, which is what a falling rate of profit, a continually falling rate of profit would mean. Now, very closely related to this question is another question, and that is, do falling prices caused by increased production reduce the rate of profit?
No.
We're out to investigate this, and this is all under point B, the heading of which is why capital accumulation and the falling prices caused by increased production do not imply a falling rate of profit. Now, when prices are falling, what is the word that is typically used to describe it?
Deflation.
Deflation. People say falling
or
prices, that's deflation. They say that's deflation. Well, what do we closely associate with deflation?
Bad economy.
Depression.
Recession, depression. And what do we associate, as far as that goes, with the rate of profit?
Decrease.
When there's a genuine deflation, when there's a serious recession or depression, the rate of profit goes down. It may be totally wiped out.
Right.
Now, if it's the case that increases in production that cause falling prices or deflation, does that mean that increases in production cause a depression? That's implied by that doctrine, that it causes deflation, that it's a wiping out of profits. Well, what we're in a position to do is provide a kind of laboratory test of these propositions. We're in a position literally to see before our own eyes whether capital accumulation and associated falling prices do in fact reduce the rate of profit. Here we are, we've calculated the rate of profit at 11.9% in our example. Now, we've already laid the groundwork for introducing capital accumulation and economic progress. We've done a lot along those lines in figure 14.5 and 15.6. We had capital accumulation there. If you remember, we were assuming that each year we had 20% more capital goods, making possible 20% more production, which would be a further 20% more capital goods and 20% more consumers' goods. What was implicitly happening to prices? If these larger supplies of goods are always selling for the same sums of money. If you may recall, we assumed that to establish economic progress, what had to happen to the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods? It had to go up. We assumed the demand for capital goods rose from 500 to 600. The demand for consumers' goods fell from 500 to 400, and that set off capital accumulation. Because in response to this changed relationship, we then had a production not merely of 1K, but of 1.2K. And what could we do with 1.2K?
More.
That enabled us to produce 20% more of both. And it went from there. Okay, well now all we're going to have to do is incorporate that framework of capital accumulation into exactly the same type of diagram that we've just looked at. We want to have a new diagram very similar to figure 16.2, but only showing capital accumulation and increase in production. And here we are. This is figure 17.1. This is profits in a progressing economy with an invariable money. And it begins in exactly the same way as did figure 16.2. Just as before, we have 1K of capital goods at a cost value of 400, 1,000 units of cash to be paid out, 1C of consumers' goods at a cost value of 400. And once again, we have the same demand for capital goods, the same payment of wages, the same net consumption. Everything is the same in year one. So no difference so far between this and figure 16.2.
Okay.
Things will begin to change in year two.
Oh, I see. Where you change it from 50 to 60 and 60
yeah.
40. I see.
Okay. Now in year two, the demand for capital goods is going to rise from 500, which it was here, up to 600. The demand for consumers' goods will drop from 500 to 400. Now, what's going to bring that about? Well, it's going to be a drop in net consumption. Up to now, the businessmen and capitalists had been personally consuming 200. They'd been productively expending 800. Now we'll assume they become more future-oriented. They suddenly perhaps become Calvinists. And they're deciding to save and productively expend more heavily. Or it could be such a thing as they have more confidence in the monetary system. They expect that a dollar saved will have as good or better buying power in the future than it has today. And so that helps them to save. Or they simply become more future-oriented. They operate at a higher conceptual level, and the future has greater meaning for them in the present than it did to people in the past. So for whatever the reason, the demand for capital goods is going to be 600, the demand for consumers' goods only 400. And that change, we're assuming, is anticipated in the production phase of year one. When the firms set about producing back in year one, they anticipate that in year two, the demand for capital goods will be 600, the demand for consumers' goods only 400, and they adjust production accordingly. So that means they will use a larger chunk of this 1K of capital goods and 1L of labor. They'll devote 60% of this to the production of capital goods in response to the 600 of demand, and only 40% of it to the production of consumers' goods. Now, why will this give rise to these different cost values, 480 versus 400, and 320 versus 400? Where do we get these new cost values from? Well, how would you get them? The question is, where does this number 480 come from?
Capital should also increase the wages associated.
Well, in what way? We still have the wages here are still 300. The capital goods is 500. What times 800 yields 480? 60%. The fact that we're devoting 60% to the production of capital goods, well, we take 60% of the 800, that's 480. Where do we get the 320?
40.
That's 40% of the 800. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, given that we are using 60%, how much capital goods do we get?
1.2.
We have 1.2 instead of 1.
1.
Okay, and we have, since we're only devoting 40% instead of 50%, 40% is to 50% as 4 is to 5, or 0.8. We have 0.8 C of consumers' goods. So these are the supplies of goods available at the start of year 2.
Okay.
And now, in year 2, 600 is expended to buy the capital goods. 600 is received for their sale in exchange for their sale. 300 is again expended for wages. Net consumption is now 100. The owners and creditors of business have reduced their personal consumption. They're consuming 100 instead of 200, and they're using the 100 that they used to personally consume, they're using that to buy capital goods. In terms of concrete examples, someone who might have been buying a super luxurious Mercedes or a Rolls Royce or whatever, instead he uses those funds to buy some equipment for his business. Someone who might have bought luxurious housing is using the funds to add to his factory. Examples of this kind. So this brings about the shift in production. Or another way this could be achieved, the taxes businesses pay are reduced, and they use the money that the government was previously consuming. Business firms now use it to buy capital goods.
Right.
This is how such a thing would occur. Okay, now here we are in the production phase of year 2, and now production is taking place with the aid of 1.2K of capital goods, and 600 has been paid for them, and also 1L of labor for which 300 has been paid. Okay, what's the total productive expenditure that's present in year 2, and that shows up here? Here. What's the total productive expenditure?
1,900.
What's the amount expended? The productive expenditure? It's 900. 600 plus 300. 600 for the capital goods, 300 for the labor. Okay, now that 900 is going to be divided 60-40.
Look at that, year 3. Or 4, I mean. That's great.
Now, here we are. When we go into year 3, we get, once again, changes in cost values. Where do we get these numbers? Where do we get the cost value of 540 and 360? It's 0.6 times 900 and 0.4 times 900 instead of 0.6 times 800 and 0.4 times 800. And so, as a result, the total cost value is 540 instead of 480, and 360 instead of 320.
Right.
Now, what has happened to the physical supply of goods produced, given that they were produced with the aid of 1.2K of capital goods rather than just 1? It's gone up, and we've made the assumption that production increases in simple direct proportion to the supply of capital goods. So if here we have 20% more capital goods than we did back here, the output will be 20% greater here than it was back there. So here we got 1.2 and 0.8, and now we're going to get 20% more than that because here we've got 20% more capital goods. So what is 20% more? What's 20% more than 1.2? 1.44. And 20% more than 0.8. 0.96. Now we arrived at these numbers, and you can still do it this way. We've always been assuming that if we did nothing with our factors of production, but produce capital goods. How much should we produce? How much could we produce when we had 1K of capital goods? We could produce 2K of capital goods and no consumers' goods, or alternatively, no capital goods and 2C of consumers' goods. And we're assuming that every time we get more capital goods, our total limits increase proportionally. So with 1.2K, we could produce up to 2.4K and no consumers' goods, mm-hmm. or no capital goods and 2.4C. And then, of course, what is 60% of 2.4? Well, 1.44. And 40% of 2.4 is 0.96. Okay, so that's where we get these outputs, and we also see where we get the cost values. Mm-hmm. Now, here we are. What are total sales revenues in year four that we're going to take it? What will be total sales revenues in year four? There'll still be 1,000, right? And in year three, what are total sales revenues?
1,000.
Okay. Now, in year three, what are the total costs that have to be deducted from those sales revenues?
900
now. Okay. What's happened to total profit? Total profit is now 100, right? Sales of 1,000, costs of 900. All right. What is the total amount of capital invested, as indicated by this? Pardon me? It's 1,900. Okay. What is the economy-wide average rate of profit?
5%.
Approximately 5%. It's what over what?
100 over 1,900.
And if you make the division, I think it comes out to, 5.25 or 5.26%. You want to calculate it if you have it?
That's right.
What?
5.2632.
Okay, 5.26%. Okay, so notice, here we are. The rate of profit has fallen. It was 11.9%. Now it's 5.26%. So there is this drop. And so far, it might appear, here we are. We've got capital accumulation, and the rate of profit is lower. But if we look just a little further,
Year four is exciting.
If we look to year four, well, in a way, it is very exciting.
Well, you're better off than you were.
If you understand the issues involved, let's notice in year four, what is the supply of capital goods available in year four? And why?
1.728.
It's 1.728. And why? What makes that possible? Well, it's because back in year three, we had 1.44K instead of just 1.2K. And what's happened to the supply of consumers' goods in year four?
One.
That's gone up another 20% also. Now, here we are. We definitely have continuing capital accumulation, right? You can see it in front of you, 1.728 versus 1.44. Also, can you infer what is happening to prices?
The
prices are falling very, very rapidly, and how do we know that? Pardon me?
You're producing a lot more goods at a much less cost.
Well, we're producing a lot more goods. That's certainly true. It also happens to be true at lower cost. But what tells us directly that prices have to fall? And you can relate it to
the number of units have been sold.
The first formula we had in the course for the price level. If you take the price level as the amount of money spent to buy goods divided by the quantity of goods sold, well, what's the amount of money spent to buy consumers' goods here and here versus the year before?
Oh, yeah.
It's unchanged, right? But how much in consumers' goods is it buying? It's buying 0.96 instead of 0.8. It's buying 1.152 instead of 0.96. So if we have an equation where we have the same amount of spending, in this case 400 of spending, and the amount it's buying is going up each year in the ratio of 6 to 5, if we have 1 divided by 6/5, what is that? If the price level equals one divided by 6/5, one representing that it's unchanged. What's one divided by 6/5?
0.833.
It's 0.833. It's 5/6. It's the reciprocal. When you divide by a fraction, you invert and multiply. So if production and supply are going up 20% a year, if it's 6/5 larger each year, and it's being bought for the same funds, that implies that each year prices are 5/6 of what they were the year before. 1/6 reduction in prices per year. That's a huge reduction, almost as fast as RAM prices perhaps have fallen, or gigabytes of hard drive, comparably fast. Now, so we've got very rapidly falling prices, and we have capital accumulation. But what has happened to the rate of profit in year four? What will be the rate of profit in year four? What are sales revenues in year four? What are total sales revenues in year four?
1,100.
Where are you getting 1,100 from?
Yeah, demand for consumer goods shows up as revenue, right?
Yeah, how much is the demand for consumers?
400. The capital goods shows up as revenues.
Yeah. Okay. And what is that?
1,000.
So sales revenues are 1,000.
Okay, we've got net consumption as an additional 100, but that's built into the consumer goods.
Net consumption is what helps to make possible the demand for consumers goods. See here, we're showing it over here. I don't think we have room to show it down here. But net consumption is not in addition to the demand for consumers goods, it's financing it. Okay, so sales revenues are still 1,000, right?
Yep.
What are the costs to be deducted from the sales revenues?
540 plus
900.
Still 900. So what's total profit? 100. And what's the total capital invested?
1,900.
And what's the rate of profit? 5.26%. Has it fallen?
No.
No, it has not. Now, even though we've had tremendous capital accumulation between years 3 and 4, and we've had a massive fall in prices, this is going on without any further fall in the rate of profit. And if we could continue the analysis out to year 6, what do you think the amount and rate of profit would be in year 6?
Same.
It would still be the same. And what would be the supply of capital goods and consumers' goods? They would be up further, another 20%, and prices would be a sixth lower, and this could continue indefinitely. So here you are, in effect, before your very eyes, you have a situation in which there's capital accumulation and falling prices caused by increased production, and there is no fall in the rate of profit resulting from either. There is a one-time fall in the rate of profit, and the rate of profit did fall early on. It fell from 11.9% to 5.26%, but notice that is a one-time only non-repeatable fall. And what brought it about? What brought about that fall in the rate of profit? What brought about the reduction in the amount of profit from 200 to 100?
Increased capital.
Yeah. What brought about the one-time reduction in the amount of profit from 200 to 100?
An increase in productive expenditure and capital goods.
Okay, an increase in productive expenditure from 800 to 900, and that served to raise costs from 800 to 900, and it reduced the difference between sales revenues and costs. We had a narrowing of the difference between sales revenues and productive expenditure. Productive expenditure rose by 100, while sales revenue stayed the same. What brought that about? How did it happen that sales revenue stayed the same, but productive expenditure rose?
Prices went down.
No, the prices didn't go down right away. What was the explanation?
It was the demand was spread.
One more time.
What brought about the sales revenues remaining the same while productive expenditure rose?
Sales revenues shifted from consumer goods to capital goods.
Sales revenues shifted from consumer goods to capital goods, but more than that, what happened?
Sales
the demand for the capital goods?
Well, the demand for capital goods rose at the expense of what?
Consumer goods.
Less spending consumer goods.
Just plain spending on consumers' goods, or what? There was a drop of net consumption. Net consumption specifically fell by 100. Net consumption fell by 100. Now, what this meant was, as a result, the demand for consumers' goods falls 100, the demand for capital goods rises 100. Now, is the 100 of demand for consumers' goods that is eliminated, did that figure into businesses' costs? Does the money that business firms pay out in dividends draw payments, financing their owners' consumption, does that show up anywhere as a cost deducted from sales revenue?
No.
It doesn't and shouldn't. But what about the money expended to buy capital goods?
Yes.
That will show up as a cost. So we had a shifting of outlays from business of a kind that did not show up as cost, namely what finances the consumption of businessmen, into outlays that do show up as cost. And we would have had the same kind of results as far as profit goes if the net consumption had fallen by 100 and the demand for labor had risen by 100. I suppose we rework the example. We start out, the demand for capital goods is 500, the demand for labor is 300, net consumption is 200. Now, net consumption falls from 200 to 100, and the demand for labor rises from 300 to 400. What's the effect on total consumption? Let's work it out. The demand, wages will be 400. Net consumption will be 100.
Okay.
Okay? What will be the demand for consumers' goods? Wages are 400.
No change.
Okay,
it would still be 500. The demand for consumers' goods in that case would be unchanged. It would still be 500. But what would happen to costs as the result of one L of labor acquired at 400 rather than 300?
More expensive.
Then costs would be greater. Costs would be greater. And what would be the effect on profits? They'd be reduced. So what reduces profits is not the change in consumption per se, it's the change in net consumption. It's net consumption.
Which could be wages.
And if we had net consumption falling to pay higher wages, total consumption would be unchanged. Total consumption would be unchanged. Here we've had a drop in net consumption, which serves to reduce total consumption. Okay, so what is bringing about the change in the amount and rate of profit? Is it A, capital accumulation, B, changes in the price level, or C, changes in net consumption?
Net consumption.
It's net consumption. That's the critical factor. The drop in net consumption, the rise in productive expenditure, that's what brings about the fall in the amount and rate of profit. Now, as the result of that happening, and bringing about the increase in the production of capital goods, what happens thereafter on the foundation of the larger supply of capital goods, on the foundation of the fact that now we have 1.2K instead of just 1K? What does that do to our ability to produce? We're now able to produce more. And now what sorts of things do we produce? Do we produce only more consumers' goods? We also produce more capital goods, too. If we have more capital goods, that's very useful, not just to produce more consumers' goods, but equally useful to produce more capital goods. Capital goods are regular products of the economic system. All right, the point is, we initially get more capital goods on the foundation of a rise in demand for them at the expense of a drop in demand for consumers' goods, at the expense of a drop in net consumption. But now we have this additional supply of capital goods. And on the basis of that additional supply of capital goods, we get a further increase in the supply of capital goods. Notice the process of capital accumulation is inertial, if you understand what I mean by that. It's in the same sense as if you apply force to an object in a vacuum, what's the effect? does this mean, is it the case that it's like a child's toy car, that if you had one in front of you and you give it a push, it will come to a stop? No, in a vacuum, it would keep on going indefinitely at a constant velocity in the same direction. And capital accumulation operates in the same way. The counterpart there of the vacuum in physics would be the positive presence of what? The positive presence of what, in order to make it possible for increases in the supply of capital goods to continually result in proportionate increases in output. What do you need for that to keep going? So that the operation of a certain law will not take hold and bring the process to a halt.
All things remain equal, improvement technology.
Pardon me?
Like technological.
Technological progress. Technological progress, exactly. That's what's necessary to offset the operation of what major law of economics?
The law of diminishing returns.
So if we have capital accumulation accompanying this greater supply of capital goods, then on the foundation of the larger supply of capital goods, we can have continuing capital accumulation. Now, notice why there is no further decline in the rate of profit. When we get 1.2K of capital goods, that's in response to a demand for capital goods of 600. The 600 to buy the 1.2, I'm sorry, I have to look up here. There's 600 to buy the 1.2K of capital goods. This 600 buys the 1.2K. Previously, 500 bought 1K. Is there any reduction or any change in the prices of capital goods implied in the year two compared with year one?
Change the price?
Yeah, in year two, we have 600 being expended to buy 1.2K. In year one, we had 500 expended to buy 1K.
Right.
No, we're increasing both in the same proportion. So the prices of capital goods would not change yet. And what about the price of consumers' goods? We're spending 400 to buy 0.8. We used to spend 500 to buy 1.0. Has the price of consumers' goods changed here in year two? No, there's less spending to buy them, but there's proportionally fewer produced. Just as with capital goods, there's more spending to buy them, and there's correspondingly more produced. But now notice, in year three, we get this second increase. We get an increase in the supply of capital goods and also consumers' goods on the foundation of this increase. This increase is brought about on the strength of greater saving, on the strength of less net consumption. Okay. But then we have this increase, and this is brought about not on the basis of a further drop in net consumption or more saving. It's brought about on the basis of the fact that we now have the additional capital goods. We have 1.2K of capital goods, and that makes it possible to produce more. So here we have 1.44K of capital goods, 20% more than we had here, and we have these additional capital goods being sold for the same 600. So what happens to the price of capital goods now in year three? Any other answer? Is there a lower bid? Why would they drop, Mr. Rosenthal?
You're getting 0.96 for 400.
That's consumers' goods.
Are you looking at the other end?
We're looking at capital goods, but what you said is right for consumers' goods.
Right.
Okay, now for capital goods, we have 600 being expended here, just like we did here.
Same concept you started on.
Okay.
If you spend $600 on lobby, you're increasing the amount of capital goods that you're getting for that same $600.
Okay, and so what's happened to the price of capital goods here?
They've dropped.
So capital goods here have dropped in the ratio of 5 to 6. We're getting 6/5 the capital goods, 1.44 versus 1.2. That's more in the ratio of 6 to 5. So prices of capital goods here are 5/6 what they are here. Okay, now, here we are. We've had this increase in the supply of capital goods, Income's about here, and it's reducing the price of capital goods, right? What is the effect of that on the unit cost of production for the product of year four? We have lower prices of capital goods in year three than we did in year two. How does that affect the unit cost of production for year four? What's it do to your unit costs if you buy your capital goods for less money?
The unit costs are down
here in the ratio of 5 to 6. And now what has happened to the productivity of labor? We have this 1L of labor. It used to produce an output equal only the limits of 2. What's it produce now? What's its total output now? Well, we have at least 20% more capital goods. What's the sum of 1.44 and 0.96? 2.4. All right, now, if the same quantity of labor produces 2.4 instead of only two, what's implied about the productivity of labor and the quantity of labor needed to produce the average unit of product? The productivity of labor has increased by 20%. What's happened to unit labor costs? It's gone down. It's 5/6. So what happens is, from year three on, because the prices of capital goods are now falling and the productivity of labor is now rising, unit costs are falling here in year three. They're falling just as much here as product prices will fall in the next year. If your unit costs fall to the same extent as your selling prices, and they fall first, what's the effect on profits?
Increases.
Here we are, we have falling prices, and every year prices are falling 1/6. Why isn't that cutting profits any further?
Because
your costs are going down. The same process is cutting the costs, and it's continually cutting the costs first. Here we are, we have 20% more capital goods here than here, and the prices of capital goods here are 5/6 of what they were here. Unless we have the same money to buy 20% more, and the productivity of labor here is 20% greater than it was here. So unit labor costs are 5/6. If you have the prices of your material inputs are 5/6, your labor cost is 5/6. Why should total profit be reduced if prices are 5/6, if the selling prices become 5/6? Mm-hmm. Well, there's no reason that they would.
That's
so here we are. We can have a continual fall in prices, a continual capital accumulation, and there is no further negative effect on the rate of profit.
As long as costs fall first.
Yeah, so long as costs fall first, and that's implied. If the production of capital goods is going up and they're being sold for the same quantity of money, what necessarily is happening to the prices of capital goods? And if we have a growing quantity sold for the same sum of money, they must be falling. And if we have the same quantity of labor producing growing quantities of product, what's necessarily happening to unit labor costs?
They're becoming more efficient.
Yeah. They're going down. Okay, now to go even further, bring this analysis a step closer to the complexity of the real world and to bring out a further significant point. Here we are, we've seen we have rapidly falling prices, but is there any continuing decline in profits?
No.
We have a constant rate of profit, in this example, at 5.26%. We have rapid capital accumulation. The rate of profit is not falling. Does this deserve to be called deflation?
No.
Is there any suggestion of depression here?
No.
No. The falling prices caused by increased production simply do not deserve the name deflation. That's a huge confusion.
Well, unless you know this stuff and you're like, hey, deflation's great for the economy.
It would be a mistake to use the word deflation to describe this. You see, there are situations of deflation. Suppose we have a financial contraction. there are bank failures, the demand for money for holding goes up, the volume of spending goes down. Now, if spending plunges, what is going to happen to profits? Why should we expect profits to be severely reduced? Yeah?
Because your demand for consumer goods and your demand for capital goods will go down.
The demand for both goes down, but why should that imply, at least for some time, that profits will be severely hurt?
Because they can't. There's no demand there, so they can't purchase either capital goods or consumer goods.
Well, they could buy them if their prices fell. What makes profit go down as the result of a plunge in spending is that your costs reflect expenditures of the past. Your costs reflect the productive expenditure of the past, not just the past year, but it may go back decades.
30 years if it's scotch.
All right, 30 years if it's scotch, or if it's durable plant and equipment. So your costs are determined, for the most part, by outlays made in the past. And they are not retroactively changeable. They are what they are. And all that changes for the time being is your sales revenues.
Right.
And if you're deducting, if you're taking reduced revenues and subtracting unchanged costs,
right,
what's happened to your profits? They may be wiped out.
Right.
Now, what will also happen to prices in that situation?
If your demand goes down, then your prices have to go down.
Okay, prices will go down. Now notice, in this situation, you have an association of a plunge in prices and a wiping out of profitability. The two are going together in this case.
Okay.
These are the joint effects of a monetary contraction. A monetary contraction will produce a wiping out of profitability. And what will it also do to the ability of people to repay their debts? It'll be much harder, so you'll have a big spike in bankruptcies. People's obligations are contractually fixed. They can't meet them. So you get, when you have a financial contraction, because people just want to hold money all of a sudden more tightly, or there's a reduced quantity of money, anything that reduces the volume of spending, that reduces sales revenues and profits, makes it more difficult to repay debt, and also results in a decline in prices. Now that's the situation that people have in mind when they say deflation. And the term deflation should be reserved for that kind of situation. It should be reserved for monetary contraction. Deflation should be used to refer to monetary contraction, one of whose symptoms is a fall in prices. Other symptoms are a plunge in profits and a spike in bankruptcies. Those are all symptoms of monetary contraction. But if we have increasing production, if we have prices falling because of more production, does that imply that profit is wiped out?
No.
We've just seen that it doesn't.
Right.
Are people plunged into bankruptcy?
No.
That's not present. So what we have is, we have two phenomena which have one effect in common. We have two radically different phenomena. One is a monetary contraction, the other is an increase in production. And they have one common effect together, and that is a fall in prices. But then they have different effects. The increase in production does not reduce the rate of profit, the monetary contraction does. The monetary contraction causes bankruptcies, a greater difficulty of repaying debt. The increase in production does not. So we have these two very different things that share one thing in common, and the others have nothing in common. Now, I'll get to you in just a minute, Mr. Boisseau. I would say that the mental processes that lead to the confusion of falling prices with deflation, which are thinking, because they have this one thing in common, falling prices, and thinking that that's synonymous with deflation, they're looking at one thing in common and totally ignoring the radical differences. They're totally ignoring the radical differences. That the one does mean a wiping out of profit, the other does not. The one does mean greater bankruptcies, the other does not. And they're treating them as the same, tarring them with the same brush, because they have this one common characteristic. Now, you may find this off the wall, but I think the epistemology, the approach to facts and the processing of it, is very, very similar to the mentality of a racist. Now, why? Just think, how does a racist judge individuals? They have one common denominator, their racial membership. That's in common. But in every other possible respect, they might be as different as night and day. And these profound differences are ignored in the name of one commonality, and everything else is overridden. Well, it's the same thing with thinking that any time there's a fall in prices, it's deflation. It's not distinguishing between different phenomena. It's lumping them as the same on the basis of one thing in common. And I'm sorry to have put you off, Mr. Boisseau.
I understand the fall in prices due to increased production do not cause deflation. What do you, and this is a great illustration, thank you, what do you call that phenomenon? Or what do you call it? What's the name for that?
Falling prices due to increased production?
Yeah. Is that what you call it, or is there some catchy name for that?
I'd say that's all you need to call that. That's what you should say. And never call it deflation. Never, ever call it deflation. Now, to go even further, and this is what I mean by bringing it yet a step closer to the complexity of the real world, if we have increasing production going on, if we've got capital accumulation and increasing production, and if at the same time we had a commodity money, such as gold and silver, what do you think would be the effect of generalized, widespread increases in the ability to produce on the ability to mine the various metals, including the precious metals? We'd have greater ability to do that. So what should we expect to be happening in the real world of increasing production to the quantity of money? We should have some increase, and what should be the effect of that on spending? That should increase too. Now, suppose we factored into this illustration, which is complicated enough, imagine that we factored in a 10% compound annual increase in money and spending.
Okay.
Now, if we did that, still what would be happening to prices? Here we are in the numerator, we have 1.1 times the spending of last year. In the denominator, we have 1.2. The supply. The supply is 1.2, the spending is 1.1. So what are prices in each year compared to the year before? They'll still be lower, right? Mm-hmm. Not as much lower. They'll be lower in the ratio of 11 to 12. They should be, that's I think 8 1/3%. Prices would be falling 8 1/3%. So here we are, we sure as enough have falling prices, right? And what would be the effect of the additional quantity of money and the growth in spending on the nominal rate of profit and on the ability to repay debts?
It should be easier.
It should be easier to repay debt, but what about, we'll get to that in a second, what about the effect on the nominal rate of profit?
What?
It should be higher. If you paid out,
oh, I see.
If you paid out 900 the year before, and now your sales revenues, instead of being 1,000, were 1,100. What's happened to your profit? It's back up 100, and now in the following year, we could expect your productive expenditure will be 990. It'll be up 10%, but by the time 990 shows up as cost, what should your sales revenues be? If they're up 10% from 1,100. They should be 1210, and so we'd have profit 1210 minus 990, and then everything keeps increasing. So actually, the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending would be adding back a monetary component, and we'd have a continuing net investment, incidentally. If we have 900 productive expenditure from last year showing up as cost this year, but this year we have 990 of productive expenditure. If we're spending 990 on account of assets, and 900 is the deductions from assets, we have 990 buying new plant and equipment, buying inventory and work in progress, while our depreciation plus cost of goods sold is 900, what's happening to our net assets, to our total assets? What happens if you add 990 and subtract 900? They increase 90. So we have net investment of 90. We have a net investment component of profit introduced on the foundation of growing money and spending. And notice this is not inflation. The prices are actually falling. Prices are still falling. And you see, under a gold standard, you'd have falling prices. The increase in production wouldn't be this great. The fall in prices wouldn't be this great. But the increase in production would tend, you'd have an increase in production and an increase in money and spending. And very likely, the increase in production would outstrip the increase in money and spending somewhat. So prices would fall. But the rate of profit, so far from being reduced, would actually be elevated to the extent of more money and spending. And then what about the difficulty of repaying debts? What's the difficulty of repaying a debt if you borrow money at a certain time? Later on, when you're selling your goods, prices are lower. Let's say you have to sell at prices that are 8 1/3% lower, but you have 20% more goods to sell. Is it harder or easier to repay a debt?
Easier.
It's easier. And now it doesn't matter how what the absolute size of the disparity is. If you have 3% more goods to sell from one year to the next, and prices are 1% lower from one year to the next, well, which is better, to sell 3% more goods at 1% lower prices, or to have your initial goods at your initial prices?
1/3.
To have the greater goods at the lower prices. So is it more difficult to repay debt? Is there a deflationist bias merely because prices are declining due to increased production? Not at all. I think these things are arithmetically demonstrable if you take the time and have the patience to work your way through. Yes, Mr. Whitesides.
Okay. So I like that you had to throw in, you threw in that part about the gold standard because, like, you had to put that in because if you didn't put it in, then, like, it's possible if you didn't have a gold standard, that your the cost of your capital goods might increase with the increased money supply. Like, it's possible that you have a gold standard to monitor it.
Well,
right? You try to keep all your factors the same, right? Like, you know, ceteris paribus, all things being equal.
Now, yes, you wanted to say something, Mr. Davis?
Yeah.
Okay. To the extent that the quantity of money and volume of spending increases, it does operate to make prices higher than they otherwise would be. They may still fall, but they won't fall as much as they otherwise would have.
Okay.
Now, I brought in the gold standard simply to show that that's an arrangement whereby you could expect prices to fall and there would be no actual deflation going on.
Right, I understand.
A major base of the opposition to the gold standard is the fallacy that it's deflationary on the basis of nothing more than that prices tend often to fall. But that doesn't mean deflation.
There you go. That's it right there. No, another quick question I had.
Yeah.
Now, you say that it's falling prices due to increased production, but not due to increased supply, right?
Well, that's the same thing. More production means more supply.
Okay. So, I mean, is it possible that you could, like, map this out as something as simple as, you know, your simple, you know, so demand, supply and demand, or is it too complex for that?
I would say there's nothing to be gained by using those curves. We're better off working. I mean, they have a value in some contexts,
okay,
but I don't think they'd be helpful here. Because
okay,
what we want to do is be aware of the dollar amounts. We want to be aware of the dollars generating sales revenues and the dollars generating costs.
Okay. But and, can it be illustrated with this or no?
Well, you can illustrate that if you have more supply, prices go down. If there's more demand, they go up. That's all you're illustrating there.
Okay.
I think it's more helpful in our context if we work with the classical economists' approach to demand and supply, which was to view prices as formed by the ratio of the spending to the quantity sold.
Okay.
And when we do that, we're in a position to make inferences about profits and costs.
But demand stays the same.
Our base assumption is the quantity of money and volume of spending stay the same. Okay. Then when we work things out that way, we're then able to introduce what happens if money and spending are rising. And we can see that there's a positive component introduced. Because the costs will always reflect the lesser spending of the year before, and the sales reflect the greater spending of this year.
Okay.
So that's why there's a positive boost. And this does not have to be inflation. You see, with the gold standard, yeah, there's more money. But not every increase in the quantity of money should be regarded as inflation, I believe. It should be the increases over and above the increase in gold.
Right.
Then you have problems. With gold, there's a positive addition to profits, but it will almost always be within the limit of the increase in the ability to produce.
Very modest, right.
It's a modest increase, tending not to be greater than the increase in production. Okay, now, there's something else that we can see here in this analysis, and this pertains to the way that wages, the way the standard of living of the average worker rises. First off, what's happening to the standard of living of the average worker as we proceed from year to year in this figure? It's improving, and what's making it improve? The prices that he pays are falling. What's happening to the wages that he's earning? That's staying the same. The wages are the same, but the standard of living is improving because the prices that are of what's being bought are falling. So real wages are going up. Real wages reflect the relationship between the money wages earned and the prices paid.
Yeah.
So real wages are rising. Now notice from what side are real wages rising here? They're rising from the side of more production and supply of consumers' goods. The real wages rise as the ability to produce goes up, as we can have more and better consumers' goods. That they're going up by virtue of increasing the buying power of the workers' wages. Yes, so, Ms. Williams.
What we have right now is what's hypothetical, but what's really happening in our economy is the opposite, correct? Because what I read in the newspaper is that the cost of living is not going as it should, like in Orange County especially.
We have many things. Normally, what's happening to the prices we pay in our life experience? They're going up year after year.
But how much? But the money supply is not fixed to the gold standard either.
And the subject we're going to be dealing with next week is inflation. And not to keep you in suspense, what's raising prices is simply the increase in the quantity of money. Now, when people think of the standard of living of the wage earner, what are they thinking of as the means by which it can be increased? What do they almost always think is the way you go about raising the standard of living? To raise wages. Their idea is the way we make the individual better off is we see to it that he has higher wages.
Right.
Now, that can be very sensible from the perspective of a given individual. If you're asking yourself, what can you personally do to raise your standard of living?
Right.
Well, you're not in a position to do anything about the general price level. You're not in a position to do anything about the general price level. What is hopefully within your power to some degree?
Cut
expenses. To earn more money. I mean, you might economize here and there, but what is within your power if you want to be able to continue to buy the goods and services you're presently buying, not have to reduce them, to buy as much as you now do, and more, you want to live better than you are. So what appears to lie within the power of any given individual? A, to buy at lower prices, or B, to earn more money?
Pay less taxes or rob a bank?
I think to earn more money.
Now,
the way that, how does an individual go about attempting to earn more money if he's not going to rob a bank or stick up a gas station? Education, improve his skills, increase his competency, raise his productivity. And now, Ms. Herrera?
Sometimes people stay at a job for a long time if they want to make more money.
They yeah.
Actually sell themselves.
Yeah.
More. Because that's actually what you're doing.
You're
selling your services, so you ask for more money.
Yeah. They can reassess what are their capabilities, what jobs are out there to which they might apply their capabilities, and maybe they haven't been making the best choice up to now, and so they might earn more money just by applying whatever abilities they have in a better position. Well, that's improving their productivity by doing that. They're devoting their time in a more fruitful way that makes better use of their talent. Yes. Right. Now, the way that we attempt to earn more money is by improving our productivity in one form or another. It might be learning brand new skills which we didn't previously possess, or applying skills that we do possess in a more fruitful way.
About what?
Yeah. Well, that's the issue of economizing, but we're assuming.
Spend less and invest
more. Well, you might spend less and invest more. That's true, but.
You might spend more too.
What I mean?
But you might spend more too, because now that money is being spent on something else.
You could change your pattern of expenditure, but. What we're interested in is how are you able to increase your overall total ability to consume, your overall total ability to buy goods and services. And the way that's open to, that appears most easily increasable to most people is to attempt to go out and earn more money. Now, what happens, we need to try to develop the connection between people becoming more productive and earning more money. The reason it appears to everyone that if you become more productive, you will likely earn more money is because they're taking for granted the presence of something which is often present but is not always present. And we want to get at that specifically. Here you are, you're getting an important degree. What's a major reason for your being in the program and wanting to get this degree?
Productive expenditure.
Well, you want to increase your earnings, right? Or make the earnings that you have more secure. It's a very important means. You're hoping to increase your earnings. And hopefully, and probably likely, you'll have success. But what will be the actual source of your ability to earn more money? It's that, it enables you to produce more, that's true, but suppose all of the people that you're competing with, suppose they were in this program, or an equally good program somewhere else, and they're getting degrees just like you. What would be the effect of that on your ability to earn more money?
Negated.
Pardon me? Yes?
Less. If you're negated, you have to do something else.
It would be negated. It would be negated. If everybody in the economy has a bachelor's degree, then having a bachelor's degree is not all of a sudden going to enable you to earn more money. Then to earn more money, maybe you have to get an MBA. But what if everyone gets an MBA? Well, then, God forbid, you have to get a PhD. Well, what makes it possible for individuals to earn more money by increasing their productivity, what is often but not always present, as these examples illustrate, is that when a given individual increases his productivity, very, very often, he's also increasing his productivity relative to the productivity of the people he competes with. And it's your increase in relative productivity that enables you to earn more money. It's the increase in relative productivity that is the source of your earning more money. If everybody is increasing their productivity to the same degree, will people earn more money? And we have that illustration right here before us. What's happening to the productivity of all of the workers who make up this 1L of labor? Here they were. They produced 0.96C and 1.44. Now they produce 1.728 and 1.152. So their productivity is rapidly rising, right? But what's happening to their wages? It's staying the same. Well, if everybody is improving his productivity to the same degree, the average member of that economy is not going to make any more money. Those people will make more money who improve their productivity relative to the rest. So if we had a situation where, on the average, people are raising their productivity 5%, those individuals would make more money who raise their productivity 10%. What would happen to those who didn't raise their productivity at all? Well, they could end up making less money. Can you think of illustrations where people increase their productivity, even a group increases its productivity, and the average member of the group ends up earning less money? We actually spent a lot of time on just this case before the midterm, which no one remembers. Okay. The potato growers.
Idaho.
Okay, all right. It's late, I forgot. Potatoes are connected with Idaho. All right, now, another illustration of this. How do labor unions feel about piecework? They oppose piecework. Why?
It increases productivity.
It increases productivity, but what's their quarrel?
Takes jobs.
Well, it might reduce the number of jobs, but what does it also sometimes do to the piece rate? Imagine we start out, workers are turning out a certain output, and now we will go to piecework. And that means every unit each worker turns out, he gets a certain amount of money for. So imagine that every little thing you did, it would put a quarter in your pocket.
Right.
And now, imagine, you know, you see people in Las Vegas, they're at the slot machines, they're pouring in quarters, they keep pulling the knob or whatever, and they're busy working, they're pumping in money, pulling. Well, imagine that you had a job. Instead of you having to put money in, you just keep pulling the handle and a quarter comes out. You pull the handle again, another quarter. You have a guaranteed little jackpot every time you pull the handle. What would you be doing?
Pull the handle fast.
You'd be trying to pull the handle as hard as you could. It would be fantastic. Well, the piecework system is a huge incentivizer. It's a tremendous incentivizer. And so what does it do to the supply of of that product or service produced?
Per unit cost of quality. I guess the argument would be quality would suffer as a result.
Well, it'll certainly increase the quantity, right?
Right.
Now, what happens if the demand is inelastic for that particular thing?
Oh, great.
So here we are. People are highly incentivized. They double their output in the same time. They become twice as productive. But isn't it possible that there'll be cases where the price per unit will fall by more than half?
Right.
Well, suppose that happens. Then what happens to the earnings of the average worker doing the piecework?
Reduced.
It's actually reduced. And that's why the unions oppose it. Now, the only people who'd make more money in that setup would be those whose productivity increased by more than the price fell. They'd make more. But those whose productivity increased by less than the price fell, they'd be making substantially less. Now, there are certainly cases which we can find where higher productivity not only doesn't mean more money, it could mean less money. On an economy-wide average, if the average member of the economy becomes X percent more productive, should that have any effect on monetary earnings, on average monetary earnings? Is there any effect here?
No.
No, there is no effect. Now, that doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Where does the benefit show up of everyone becoming more productive?
The real wages.
Real wages will go up, but from what's the source of their rise? It's not people earning more money. It's the prices that they have to pay going down.
Right.
So real wages are rising, not through people earning more money, but through prices becoming lower. Now, what is it that allows the average member of the economy to earn more money, to earn more wages? Is it that they become more productive?
Relative.
Well, not everyone can be relatively more productive to everybody else. if everyone is trying to be more productive, if I become twice as productive relative to you, then you're half as productive relative to me. You can't be more productive relative to me and me more productive relative to you. That's like saying I'm taller than you and you're taller than me. Not possible. So the average monetary earnings in the economy do not go up because people are more productive. The earnings of those go up who are relatively more productive, who increase their relative advantage, they go up, but then the others go down. There can be a general benefit, but only from lower prices of what they buy. Well, what is it that allows the average member of the economy to earn more money?
Increase in production.
No, here we have increases in production. Yes?
Prices falling?
Well, here we have prices falling. You can't think of anything that underlies the average member of the economy earning more money?
More money?
Yes?
Increase in money supply.
An increase in the money supply. An increase in the money supply. If there's more money and more money being spent, then there's more money received, the average member of the economy will earn more.
Oh, I see.
So what allows the average rate of wages to go up for everybody is simply the fact that there's more money. Now, the only thing that allows the additional money to have greater buying power, to end up being able to buy anything more, is what? The increase in production. The increase in production.
Right.
So if we have a system where the two were keeping pretty much in pace, if over a generation, let's say, the quantity of money doubled, the average money wage doubled, and if also the ability to produce doubled, well, then people would be earning twice the wages, and what would have happened to prices?
Gone down.
Well, they would at least have been unchanged. If we have twice the goods and twice the money, then prices would be unchanged. But still, what would be the source of people being better off? Is it the fact that they're earning more money?
Twice the goods.
By me?
Twice the goods.
It's twice the goods. It's that they had become twice as productive. And we had, I think, extensive discussion of the productivity of labor and its relation to real wages. Real wages rise not the way people usually think they do. They don't rise by virtue of people earning more money, not the general level of real wages. The overall economy-wide general level of real wages rises only because of the increase in the ability to produce. That's what keeps prices down relative to wages. That's what enables the wages to buy more. See, what does it take for double the wages to buy double the goods, rather than having double the prices of the same goods?
Increased productivity.
Increased production. See, if we just increase the quantity of money, we could double money wages easily enough. But if you have double the money being spent for the same goods, what happens to prices? Prices right. double, and there's no benefit. Well, right. what do you need so that double the wages will be accompanied by unchanged prices?
Increased production.
If production doubles too, then the prices can stay the same. But what is it that's allowing the improvement? See, compare the two scenarios. In one, we have more money, we double wages. We're doubling spending for consumers' goods. If that's all that happens, what happens to prices?
They double.
They double. Now, if then we add in that production doubles, what's the effect of that on prices compared to what they would have been just on the foundation of more money? If they end up staying the same instead of doubling, what's the contribution of the greater production?
Yeah. I have another question.
Okay, well, it's the prices have been halved compared to what they would have been. They end up being the same instead of doubled. Oh, yes, Mr. Rosenthal.
So what is it that has caused prices in the past 30 years to increase, although production and technology improvements have been made?
Okay.
I have an answer.
Okay.
Is it only the money supply?
Yeah, the money supply is out of control. They're printing billions of dollars a day.
Well, not a day, but it's the increase in the quantity of money and volume of spending. And we're going to go into... Yeah. We'll go into that, and that'll be the first topic we go into next week. So, yes, Mr. Davis.
What's the effect on the increased money supply and Bush's current stance with all this additional money into the economy, it's overall stimulating the economy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now we're seeing some of our foreign investors saying that we don't like what we're doing with the devaluation of the dollar.
Yeah.
Is beginning to have some effects. And what do you think the long-term effects of the devaluation of the dollar
What are the long-term effects? Well, it depends on how long this policy is continued. If they just keep it up and the dollar is looking like it's going to go down further and further and further, then it's possible that people with massive holdings of dollars outside the country might decide they no longer want to hold so many dollars, and then those dollars return here, and that would very substantially add to our problems. The consequences of our inflation have been held down to the extent that people all over the world want to take the additional dollars. But if we create them to the point where they don't want to hold them, then we'll be stuck with them, and there'll be quite a jump in prices. Okay, see you all next week.
This is George Reisman speaking in 2020. The subject of next week's lecture will not be inflation, but a critique of Keynesianism. My discussion of inflation will take place the week after that. The accompanying syllabus supplement will be Supplement 7, not 8. Supplement 8 will accompany the discussion of inflation.